Well, as you know, as you've heard from Paraga last night, the theme of this weekend is fearlessness. So I'm going to give you a talk about fearlessness. I've been terrified of doing this all week. Well, actually, I've been giving public talks for quite a while, so I'm not that scared anymore. But I couldn't resist the joke. Actually, Paraga nearly stole it from me last night. I was a bit worried about that. And this fear of public speaking, I mean, it's got a long and venerable history as one of the things we human beings tend to fear. So as you'll know, as you'll be discovering if you're sort of coming new to the Dharma, is that one of the great things about Buddhism is lists. It's got lots of lists. And there's even a list in the Pali Canon of the five fears, the fivefold fear, the five things that the Buddha's disciples seem to have been prey to fearing. And these are fear of losing your livelihood, fear of blame and disapproval, fear of death, fear of a bad rebirth, and fear of speaking in front of large assemblies. It's right up there with the top ones. And things haven't changed that much in 200 years, actually. In one of his books, Vasantra talks about some research on the things people feared in the present day. And when people were asked what their main fear was, public speaking came out top. Ahead, apparently, of death. And I think this fear of public speaking that's affected people ever since the days of the Buddha, I think it tells us something about the nature of a lot of our fear. First, it tells us a lot of our fear is groundless, okay? Because it relates to things that can't actually harm us. So it serves no useful purpose. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It can paralyze us. Okay, fear of tigers might serve a useful purpose. If it makes us run for our life when we see one. But fear of public speaking? I mean, no matter how bad this talk is, I very much doubt that you're actually going to throw things at me or cause me grievous bodily harm or lynch me afterwards. In fact, being Buddhists, you'll probably be so anxious to make me feel better for having given such a rubbish talk that you'll all be really nice to me and tell me how wonderful it was. So that's one thing about a lot of our fear. It relates to things that aren't going to actually hurt us. It's completely misplaced. And I think the second thing that this widespread fear of public speaking tells us about fear in general is that we experience most fear when we are most focused on ourselves. Standing in front of a lot of people really can focus our attention on the impression we're making. And I remember when I first started doing a lot of teaching at a Buddhist centre, standing up in front and giving maybe several talks a week, this caused me quite a lot of anxiety because day in and day out I was doing this thing that many of us fear. So I talked to my preceptor, Subhuti, about this, and I explained what I was feeling and I asked him what I could do about all this anxiety. And what he said was, "You feel that anxiety because when you are standing in front of an audience, you are thinking about yourself. It's about you. When you stand up in front of an audience, what you are focusing on is the impression you might be making, what people think of you, whether they will admire you, whether they will think you're giving a good talk, whether you will look a fool. So of course you feel anxious. Of course you feel anxious. The way to conquer that anxiety is to stop it being about you and make it about them. Make it about the audience. Make it about saying what will help your audience as much as you can. So try to put yourself in their shoes. Try to summon up some metta for your audience. And think about how you can benefit them as much as you can by what you say, rather than thinking about yourself and the impression you're making. And if you do that to the best of your ability, then, well, it doesn't matter what impression, you don't have to worry about the impression you're making, because that's not the purpose of what you're doing. Your purpose of what you're doing is to benefit them, and you've done that as well as you could. Of course, what he said is true, actually. I mean, to the extent that I've ever managed to do that, it's meant that my whole approach to public speaking was quite different. So what he said is true. Fear of public speaking, like a lot of other fear, is comes from focusing on ourselves rather than focusing on something that goes beyond the self. Focusing on the self is the way to feel anxious. It's the main cause of all the useless fear and anxiety that we feel. And the more we free ourselves from this tight little focus on me, the more we will free ourselves from fear. As Paragus said last night, if we go completely beyond our deluded sense of ourselves as fixed, separate entities, if we get real insight into the nature of things, we'll be completely free from fear, as the Buddha seems to have been completely free from fear. But even this side of enlightenment, even before we completely see our through our delusion of being a separate self, we can do a lot to reduce our fear and anxiety. To the extent that we go beyond our tight focus on ourselves, to that extent, we liberate ourselves from fear. And the way we might do that is what I mainly want to talk about this morning. So not necessarily all the way to enlightenment, but what we can do in the meantime, as it were, to free ourselves from fear. So, but before I want to launch into that, I want to say something about the title of this weekend. So the title of this weekend is Fearlessness. Well, I think that fearlessness would be a thoroughly bad thing, at least for us. Fear of things that can really harm us is a useful emotion, actually. Fear of tigers is great if it makes us steer clear of tigers. Fear of what could happen in a car crash might keep us driving safely and keep us under the speed limit. It'd be a useful emotion, a good thing. And fear is even a useful spiritual emotion. It can motivate us on the spiritual path. It's perfectly reasonable to fear the suffering we can create for ourselves by ignoring the law of karma, for example. If we behave in certain ways over time, we will become a certain sort of person with certain sorts of mental states, and there are mental states we definitely don't want to spend a lot of time in. There are places we definitely don't want to go, and if we have any sense, we'll fear those places, and that fear can motivate us to act skillfully. And in his teaching, actually, the Buddha uses fear. The Buddha uses fear as a motivator. So there's an example, there's a sutta in the Pali Canon called the cliff, or the big drop-off or something, in which the Buddha tells us how one day he took his followers to a place called Inspiration Peak, where there's this huge precipitous drop down to the plains beneath. And when they got there, in the translation of the Buddha of the sutta that I've got, it has the Buddha's disciples saying, "Wow, what a huge drop! Wow, what a huge drop-off. What a really huge drop-off." They sound really stupid. Anyway, what a really huge drop-off. Is there any drop-off more huge and frightening than this? To which the Buddha replied, "There is, bhikkhus, a drop-off more huge and frightening than this. And that is the drop-off of sickness, old age, and death. And if you are not aware of how terrifying that precipice is, you will complacently distract yourself with the pleasures of samsara. You won't be released from sickness, old age, and death. And you will fall over that terrifying cliff into sorrow, death, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. But if you do know how terrifying that drop-off is, you'll practice the path towards liberation and you'll be released from sickness, old age, and death. You will not fall over the terrible cliff into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair." So the strong stuff from the Buddha, using fear as a positive emotion, an emotion that makes us avoid what we need to avoid and do what we need to do. So for us, short of enlightenment, fear is not necessarily a bad thing. It can protect us from physical harm and it can protect us from spiritual harm. What we need to do is to distinguish between fear that is useful and fear that's useless. So I'm going to talk about how we can free ourselves from useless fear. That's what I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to do that under two headings. I'm going to talk about anxiety, the sort of state of low-level pervasive fear that can be a sort of background state of mind that latches itself on to all sorts of unimportant things. And I'm going to talk about the fear that limits us, that stops us spreading our wings, that stops us moving into a new being, stops us becoming the person we could become. So I'm talking about those two types of fear and what we can do about them. So first of all, anxiety. Anxiety seems to be the bane of the present age, actually. It seems to be just about the most common emotional problem for an awful lot of people in our society. When we run introductory classes at our Buddhist centre, we introduce the five hindrances, which you'll probably know, the five mental habits that get in the way of meditation. So desire for sense experience, ill will, anxiety and restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt and indecision. So we introduce these five lovely habits that get in the way of meditation, and we take a poll. Which of these is the biggest problem for you in your life as well as in your meditation? And anxiety wins hands down every time. It often gets more votes than all the other hindrances put together. So despite the fact that actually there's not much to be scared of in most of our lives, not in any one day in life in the UK, we're very unlikely to be eaten by a tiger, as you might have been in the Buddha's day, or to be murdered, certainly not in Britain. And we've got such good health care and such good society that most of us actually live to a ripe old age. And yet many of us live under the shadow of anxiety. So why? Why so much anxiety when there's so much less to be feared than there was, for example, in the Buddha's day? As I said earlier, as long as the focus of our thoughts is on ourselves, we're bound to feel anxious. And we live in this really individualistic society that encourages us to treat our own wants and concerns as all important. And what we need to overcome that anxiety is a focus on something bigger and more important than our own concerns. A sense of meaning and purpose and direction in our lives. And we live in a society that doesn't encourage us to look for that sense of meaning. We're supposed to look for happiness in having loads of stuff and being entertained all the time. So we have a sort of epidemic of anxiety because we're doing all the things that conduce to anxiety as a society. So just to expand on that a little, I can think of at least three ways in which this focus on ourself with no higher purpose leads to anxiety. So for a start, if we're focused on what we want, we're fighting a losing battle. The universe does not care what we want. In fact, we are these little blobs, these really fragile blobs of protoplasm clinging to a rock, which is hurtling at unimaginable speed through the vacuum of space, and we want security, and we want things to go our way. It ain't going to happen. And if we don't have a sense of meaning and direction in our lives that puts our own personal wants in a bigger perspective, well, we're going to be anxious. We're going to be anxious about what's going on. In the end, we're going to face sickness, old age, and death. And if we're just focused on ourselves, well, what bigger catastrophe could there be? If we're focused on something bigger than ourselves, well, it might be a bit different. To a leaf, autumn is a terrible holocaust. If the leaf doesn't see itself as about something bigger than itself. So, yeah, if we're just focused on ourselves, well, you know, we're bound to be anxious because the universe ain't going to cooperate. Secondly, if we aren't about anything bigger than our own personal concerns, then we don't have any real basis for making decisions that's more stable than our own changeable whims and feelings. So we're likely to experience a lot of indecision. There's massive choice available to us in present society, and we've got no real way of deciding which way to go. And indecision, not knowing which way to go, is a great promoter of anxiety. So I said earlier, in our introductory classes, we do this poll, and anxiety comes out top. And then we talk a little bit more about the hindrances. And one of the things we say is, well, actually, sometimes a hindrance can be just the surface symptom. And sometimes anxiety can be the surface symptom, but what's under it is doubt and indecision. It's just not knowing which way to go, which is the problem. And then we take a different poll, we take another poll, and very often we get a different result. Because very often people say, actually, it's doubt and indecision that's my real problem, and that's what's causing me all this anxiety. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to live my life. I'm constantly shilly-shallying, trying to keep my options open, and that makes me really anxious. So that's the second reason, not having any basis for making decisions that goes beyond our changeable whims and feelings. And I think a third reason why focusing on ourselves and not having a bigger sense of purpose causes anxiety is simply that at some level it makes us very disappointed with ourselves. Something inside us knows that we've got the potential to be more than that, and it will keep prodding and poking us as long as we ignore it. And the way it often prods and pokes us is to make us feel anxious if we're not living a meaningful life. Comes out as a sort of non-specific anxiety. So there's a man called Reginald Ray who wrote a well-known book called Secrets of the Vajra World. Great title. I mean, with a title like that, you know, it doesn't matter what's in the book, it's going to sell. I wish I'd thought of it. Secrets of the Vajra World. Anyway, in Secrets of the Vajra World, Reginald Ray talks about what he calls Buddha nature. I don't actually like that term, but I'll use his terminology for a while. He talks about Buddha nature. And he says that many people in the West think that Buddha nature is what gives them a lovely sense of spaciousness and expansiveness that maybe they sometimes experience in meditation. He says, that's my Buddha nature. But he says, actually, as long as we're not living a life that allows our Buddha nature to manifest, what this so-called Buddha nature does is it makes us anxious and dissatisfied. It irritates us in an effort to make us change. It's sort of like, it's like this little thing trying to get out, and it's not going to rest. Buddha nature is what makes us anxious and dissatisfied, and maybe even depressed, as long as we aren't living a life with real purpose. So as I said, I don't really like this term Buddha nature because it can lead some people to think that, well, I'm already a Buddha, therefore I don't have to do anything. I'd rather talk about Buddha potential. But I think Reginald Ray is right, that if we live a life that ignores our Buddha potential, then this in itself can be the cause of a lot of anxiety. Our Buddha potential is like a constant irritant. As long as we're living a life that's beneath us. We are spiritual beings. We're spiritual beings. And if we live a life that ignores that fact, or that tries to ignore that fact, something inside us that is not being expressed will make us anxious. So I think for these three reasons, and maybe more, focusing on our own wants and not having a greater sense of purpose and meaning, results in anxiety, results in this sort of pervasive sense of anxiety. So I reckon that any clear sense of purpose and meaning in life, as long as it's basically skillful, and as long as it's about something bigger than ourselves, any clear sense of purpose will free us from anxiety to some extent. So I can't imagine, for example, Nelson Mandela, when he was fighting for the freedom of his people and a decent political system in his country, I can't imagine him being anxious about his bank account or whether his you know, clothes had got the right label, or whether he got the right mobile phone, or etc. etc. I'm sure that he was totally focused on that and not on him, not on his own little stuff. I can't imagine. Yeah, I can't imagine the Dalai Lama being greatly anxious about how his hair is or something like that, you know, his appearance. And if any commitment to a skillful sense of purpose and meaning tends to free us from anxiety, then the sovereign antidote to anxiety is a commitment that expresses the highest values and is based on the most universal principles. And for me, that's represented by the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So for me, as far as I can see, the sovereign antidote for anxiety is what we call going for refuge to the three jewels, going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So if you're relatively new to the Dharma, to Buddhism, this term going for refuge can be a bit of a puzzle. It's a sort of a Buddhist code, really. And at first, some people really don't take to it. In fact, I didn't really take to it. It can sound a bit cowardly. It can sound as though we're running away from something to some sort of refuge. But actually, we have to sort of just get our heads around what it means, really, because we all go for refuge to something. In a life that's fragile and transient and fleeting and unpredictable, we all try to rely on something. We all grasp at something for a bit of meaning or a bit of comfort. So some of us go for refuge. Lots of people go for refuge to money and possessions. Some people go for refuge to their house. It's got to be the best house. Some people go for refuge to career. Some people go for refuge to a family. Some go for refuge to pleasures and distractions. Whatever. And the trouble is that all those refuges are still basically about our own small, fragile self. They are no real refuge from fear. They don't work as a refuge from fear. Going for refuge to the three jewels means that what becomes most important to us, what's central to our life, is not any of those normal refuges like money or house. What becomes most important to us is nurturing our own Buddha potential and helping others to nurture theirs. What becomes important to us is bringing more wisdom and compassion into the world. It means practicing the Dharma and spreading the Dharma and helping others to practice the Dharma. It means that what becomes central to us is participating in Sangha, spiritual community, participating in spiritual community, helping to bring spiritual community, Sangha, into existence and helping it to grow. So our going, what we call our going for refuge, our commitment to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, it needs to involve us moving towards the Buddha, as Paraga said yesterday, us moving towards the Buddha ourselves, expressing more and more of our Buddha potential. But it also needs to be about others. If it is just about me and my mental states and even my insight, it is still focused on me. It's still focused on the self, and it doesn't have the same liberating effect. It will not have the same liberating effect. So it needs to be about others as well as ourselves to be effective. So you will almost certainly have seen images of the Buddha making what's called the mudra, the gesture of fearlessness. The mudra of fearlessness. Bizarrely, it's one of the very, very few gestures of the Buddha we haven't got one of in this shrine room. But the Buddha making the gesture of fearlessness. So we've got quite a big standing Buddha in our centre making this gesture. And you sometimes see people really sort of taken aback by it. And some of the time it's just part of my sort of mental background, but if I really look at it, it never fails to impress me, this gesture of fearlessness. The standing Buddha in this gesture of fearlessness. It's such a striking image. The Buddha is communicating something through that gesture very directly. I give you freedom from fear. I give you freedom from fear. It's like a direct personal communication, a gift almost. Freedom from fear. It's saying, meet me. move towards me, align yourself with me, and I will give you freedom from fear. And the way to do this is to nurture our own Buddha potential and that of others, to grow towards the Buddha by practicing the Dharma and participating in Sangha. In that way, our volition becomes part of the great current of volition running towards a more enlightened world, which the Buddha set in motion. In a sense, we become part of the Buddha, and the Buddha's fearlessness becomes our fearlessness. And the Buddha makes this point, he actually makes this point in a really mythic and colourful sutta in the Pali Canon, called the Standard or the Flag. So in this sutta, the Buddha says, the Buddha's telling this story, and he says, well, once the Devas, the gods were arrayed for battle against the anti-gods. They were all on their horses and their chariots, and their armour was all polished and shining, and their swords and lances were all sharpened, and their flags were all waving. And before this great battle, Saka, the leader of the gods, addresses his troops as kings and generals address their troops before a great battle. So he stands up there, and in his pep talk he says, if you feel afraid, if your courage wanes, if you feel daunted and you want to run away in this great battle, look for my battle standard. Look for my battle standard, my flag, which will be waving up above the chaos. You'll see my battle standard. And my standard will remind you of who you are and what you are and what you're fighting for. And when you see my standard, my courage will flow into you, and you'll be free from fear. But in the sutta, the Buddha tells his followers, this ain't going to work. This ain't going to work, actually. Because Saka, the king of the gods, is himself subject to all sorts of emotions that come from him not being beyond the delusion of self, like craving and ill will. So Saka himself is subject to fear, the king of the gods. He's subject to anxiety. Seeing his flag above the chaos is no real help, because he hasn't got freedom from fear to give. What you should do instead is look for my standard above the chaos. Look for my flag above the chaos of life. And I will give you freedom from fear. So then the Buddha goes on to say, well, the way to do this is to call the Buddha to mind, to meditate on the Buddha and his qualities, and then to call him to mind in the chaos of daily life. In other words, remember you're going for refuge to the Buddha. Remember your commitment to manifesting your own Buddha potential, and that will free you from fear. So the Buddha says, practice recollection of the Buddha, and extend this to recollection of the Dharma and recollection of the Sangha. And that is the way to go beyond fear. That will be like seeing my battle standard above the chaos. That will be like meeting me as I make this gesture of fearlessness, because you also have the potential for fearlessness in yourself at your highest. So as far as I'm concerned, for me, going for refuge to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha is the royal road to freedom from anxiety. If we go towards the Buddha, if we meet him and let him bestow fearlessness on us, a lot of our anxiety will just drain away. It won't mean that we never experience fear or anxiety again. We've still got the delusion of separate selfhood. And from my experience, is anxiety can become a bit of a habit. And even when you've to some extent gone beyond it, it's still sort of there. So we won't be totally free from fear and anxiety. It's not that we'll never experience fear and anxiety again if we really commit ourselves to the Buddhist path. But it will mean that we have a stable place to stand. We'll have deep roots, so that when these feelings do come up, they can't blow us around. We'll have the stability that's expressed by another one of the gestures. I've talked about the gesture of fearlessness. There's another of the gestures that the Buddha is often shown making, which is the gesture of touching the earth. The gesture of touching the earth. We've got it up here with somewhere. Yes, with Akshobhya touching the earth. So the gesture of touching the earth, reaching down and touching the earth. The Buddha is said to have made that gesture when he was challenged. He was challenged about his right to sit on the throne of enlightenment by Mara. But in a way, irrespective of the story, just the gesture itself expresses something powerful and important. The gesture itself says, here I stand. Well, actually, here I sit. I am grounded in something much larger than myself. I've got those deep roots. And although all sorts of things might sweep over me and all sorts of winds might try to blow me about, I've got such deep roots that I cannot be moved. I'm grounded in something big and worthwhile. I think that's what that gesture expresses. So having those deep roots into something bigger than ourselves that we get from going to refuge for the key, to the Buddha, I think is also the key to working with the second aspect of fear that I want to talk about, which is freeing ourselves from the fear that limits us, that stops us from spreading our wings, that stops us from being more than we've got used to being, if you like. So, as I said before, having a clear sense of purpose and direction, going for refuge, will cause a lot of our fear and anxiety to drop away. But we will still experience it. So I'm not going to talk about fearlessness. I'm going to talk about how we work with fear. How we work with the fear that we will have. Not how we become fearless, but how we become free from fear, in the sense that we don't let our feelings of fear limit our freedom. We can rise above them. So I was once told, I can't remember where I got this idea from. I was once told that they have a way of training elephants in the East where the elephant is meant to move piles of wood from one place to another in a particular area. And the way the elephant is trained not to sort of roam beyond that area is that when it's a little baby elephant, it's a rope is put around its neck, which is attached to a stake. So the baby elephant can go in a circle around that stake. And of course, the baby elephant charges around and every now and then it's brought up by the rope. And after a while, the baby elephant, by the time the baby elephant is big enough that it could just pull the stake out and run for it anyway, it's got used to the fact that every time it gets near to the edge of this circle, something terrible happens. So it stops even trying. So then when it's a great big elephant that nobody could stop, the rope can be taken off, and the elephant never goes outside its circle. The circle has become like the elephant's comfort zone, and as soon as it gets to the edge of it, it feels afraid. And I think we're a bit like that. We've got used to being in a particular circle. Maybe we're trained to stay in that circle by our parents, by our background, by all sorts of things. And if we get towards the edge of that circle, we start to feel afraid. Fear comes up whenever we expand the range of our being, of our behaviour. Asking total strangers for money for a charity they've never heard of might be not something we've done before, and it might be terrifying. Having a difficult conversation, fessing up to something that we'd rather not sort of own up to, doing something that goes against social norms, that isn't the sort of thing we're used to doing. Can't do that. So we're limited. So I could give you a couple of examples from my own experience of limiting fears. So one actually does concern door-to-door fundraising. I remember when I was sort of about to start doing door-to-door fundraising, I'd walk past houses and I'd imagine going up to those doors and knocking on them, and I would be terrified, to be frank. And when I first came to the door, it's just not something I did. I didn't ask total strangers for money. So when I first, now is my start, my first house. It's like there's a huge demon above that door, and I've just got to, it's saying, don't do this, you don't do this sort of thing. It's fear. I just have to summon up a certain amount of warrior energy and walk through that demon. Walk through that demon. and suddenly the demon disappears. In my experience, it's not enough to sort of passively be in the gap with regard to feelings of fear. I actually have to summon up something to challenge that. I have to summon up some warrior energy and go into battle against it. So I did that, and eventually I could knock on doors and ask people for money and feel, actually, be free enough from fear to actually engage people with a certain degree of metta for them. It becomes about them rather than about me and my concerns. I want to make it a pleasant experience for them. I want to give them an opportunity. So that's one, you know, that was a limiting fear. There was no, you know, nothing was going to harm me from going up and knocking on a door. It was just a fear that was limiting my range of action, limiting the sort of person I could be. There was no point to it. And it needed to be challenged. A second example of a fear arising from just going beyond social norms that was stopping me from sort of stepping out and just being free in a way, actually goes back a long time. It goes back to when we were originally getting Gushaloka together. And I was there with Subhuti, among others. And Subhuti was arranging a series of lectures for Sangharakshita in Spain. And I was travelling around with him because I spoke Spanish, so I was acting as translator. And we managed to blag our way into speaking to the principal of a pharmaceutical college in Alicante to ask him about whether we could use his lecture theatre for Bhante to give a talk, for Sangharakshita to give a talk. That's not something I would have done anyway if Spooty hadn't been there, because I would have been too scared, actually, to try that. I would have thought, that's not going to work. I don't do that sort of thing. Anyway, but we talked our way into speaking to this principal, and he said, yes, you can use my lecture theatre for your talk. And then he's obviously had some second thoughts, and he said, ah, but I need a letter from you saying you've got no political agenda and no financial agenda. So, okay. So we come out. Nice day, Alicante, sunny. I should say that we're really scruffy because we've been living up a mountain for some time. So, you know, I tend to be scruffy anyway, but I was particularly scruffy. I'm thinking, we go back up our mountain, I get out our old typewriter and in my sort of anxious way try and peck out this letter in my fairly limited Spanish, actually. And we send it off. But nearly opposite the pharmaceutical college is this really flash office machines shop, okay? And this is before computers. This is when people had sort of flashy electric typewriters. And this is a particular sort of continental shop, marble floors, frosted, smoked glass windows, women in very smart suits clicking around on high heels, and guys in dead sharp suits with immaculate hair. This is selling expensive office machinery to, you know, people with a bit of status. And I'm really scruffy, and I don't speak very good Spanish, actually. And Subhuti says, why don't you go in there and borrow a typewriter? Why don't you go in there and ask to use a typewriter to write this letter? This is not something that the me I had created up until then does. I do not do that. I do not go into those sorts of places and make outrageous requests while dressed like a bum. The only reason I did it is because Booty was there, to be honest. But summon up some energy, walk in. Excuse me, I have a really urgent letter to write. This woman clacks over to me, clack, 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 clack. Sign, alien. There's an alien in the shop. Excuse me, I've got this really urgent letter to write. I wonder if I could borrow a typewriter. I'll go and see the manager. Clack, 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 clack. Manager comes back. Excuse me, I've got this really urgent letter to write. I wonder if I could borrow a typewriter. I suppose so. Would that one do? Yeah, okay. Would you get this man a desk? Okay, thank you. Your chair. Can I borrow some paper? I'm not that fluent in writing Spanish anyway, so I write this letter. Can I borrow an envelope? Thank you. I mean, this is just not within the range of my, you know, it's not what I do. But actually, afterwards, it felt completely exhilarating experience. Why not be totally outrageous? Why be constrained by social roles? Why not just be completely free to do what's effective? Unconditioned in a way, you know, unconditioned by just what we normally think of as doing. But So I was actually really, at first I thought, Sabuti, you know, I'm not, but actually I felt really grateful to him. I thought, well, actually you've pushed me beyond the range of my, what I normally do. And actually that's really a great thing. So yeah, fear. Fear is what we experience when we're asked to knock on strangers' doors and ask for money, or go into really posh office machine shops and ask to borrow a typewriter. Fear comes up. Or all sorts of lesser things, all sorts of lesser things, but they're outside of our range of experience, outside the range of what we do. Fear comes up. It's a feeling. It's just like any other feeling. It might be telling us something useful. It might be saying there's real danger here, but in the case of fear, it usually isn't. So we need to experience it. We need to feel it, but we don't want to be ruled by it. There's a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. Another great book title. I haven't read it, but it's a great title because it describes exactly what we need to do. Feel the fear and do it anyway. Feel the fear, but have the freedom to do the scary thing anyway. Not being ruled by fear, but deciding for ourselves. As I've said, in my experience, the way to do that, I can't do that by sort of passively being in the gap with regard to fear. I actually have to summon up the opposite sort of energy. I have to summon up courage, warrior energy. I have to go into battle against it. When fear comes up, we experience what's been called the flight or fight reaction. It's in the body. It's in the body. And I think flight or fight, in my experience, it sums up the choice we have. We can run away from fear. That's what we want to do. We want to sort of avoid the fear and avoid the thing that makes us fearful. So we can run away from fear, or we can summon up some warrior energy, turn round, look it in the face, and challenge it. I reckon that my experience is that's the way to do it. We have to actually challenge the fear. We need to summon some warrior spirits, some Vajrapani spirits, I will tend to think of Padmasambhava, because Padmasambhava to me represents something to do with that challenging of fear. Or we could think of the Buddha. We need to look for the Buddha's battle standard above the chaos and let that give us that courage to go into battle, to challenge it, and then do it anyway. And when we do that, it's the fear that turns out to be cowardly. The fear itself turns tail and runs away as soon as we challenge it. It's not like anything so scary at all when we do it. And the energy we get from the fight, flight or fight reaction becomes available to us. It makes us sharper, makes us more on the ball, loads more precise and vivid, so that we're actually better at what we do. So we need to not run away from fear. We need to turn and face it and challenge it. And the Buddha talks about that. He talks about how he himself did that before he was enlightened. So there's a sutta in the Pali Canon again called the Discourse on Fear and Terror. And in that sutta, a Brahmin asks the Buddha about all these guys going and spending all the time in the forest, whether it isn't terrifying for them, and doesn't it actually undermine them, that they're going to be scared all the time? Doesn't it undermine their self-possession and their ability to concentrate, to be in the woods, in the dark, in the middle of nowhere? And the Buddha says, well, yes, maybe it could be like that. Maybe it could be like that. And that's why, before I was enlightened, I decided to make it a practice to go to what he describes the sorts of places that are awe-inspiring and make your hair stand on end. I don't know if you've ever been completely alone in a forest at night, but actually it can summon up all sorts of completely illogical fears. And what the Buddha says is he took himself off to these really scary places on his own. And he says, if while I was staying there, a wild animal would come, or a bird would make a twig fall, or a wind would rustle the leaves, I would think, this is fear and terror coming. And he says, then I thought, what happens if instead of letting it come, instead of being passive in its face, let's say, I were to turn the tables and attack it and subdue it? So when fear and terror came while I was walking back and forth, I wouldn't change my position. I would keep walking back and forth until I had subdued that fear and terror. If fear and terror came while I was standing, I would keep standing and I would subdue that fear and terror. If fear and terror came while I was sitting, I would keep sitting until I had subdued that fear and terror. And so on, while I was lying down, etc., etc. So, not do something different. I think that the fact that he carries on doing the same thing means he doesn't sort of try and distract himself from it. He doesn't run away from it into some other activity. What he does instead is attack it and subdue it in an active manner. I would subdue it. I would actively turn and fight it. So the Buddha's approach was to notice the feeling of fear and terror and to subdue it. He was saying the way to deal with pointless fear is to challenge it in a way like a warrior going into battle, and never to run away from it. So I think we need to do that. And I think to do that, we need a reason to sort of activate that warrior energy, if you like. We need to go into battle. We need a cause to fight for. We need a cause to fight for. And the cause that I think works best is a commitment to principles and values that are true enough and beautiful enough to override what we happen to be feeling at any one time. We need to look for the Buddha's standard above the chaos of daily life and go on his side into battle. We need to go for refuge. So I started this talk by talking about fear of public speaking as an example of a pointless limiting fear. And I'd like to end by telling a story about public speaking that illustrates just how powerful, just how effective and free from fear it's possible to be. If we respond wholeheartedly to a call that is much bigger than ourselves. And this is a story about Sangharakshita, the founder of the Triratna community. So Sangharakshita found himself in Nagpur in central India one December on the day, I've got 6th of December, XXXX. Anyone fill me in what the date was? No. Anyway, he found himself in Nagpur on the 6th of December of the year something. On the very day that Dr. Ambedkar had died, that it was announced that Dr. Ambedkar had died. So Dr. Ambedkar was the great leader of the Dalit communities, the communities that used to be called untouchable communities, who had been terribly discriminated against and downtrodden in India for thousands of years. And he found himself in Nagpur on the day that Dr. Ambedkar died. Just a few weeks earlier, Dr. Ambedkar had led hundreds of thousands of his followers to turn their back on the Hinduism that kept them in that subservient position and to convert to Buddhism. And Nagpur had been the centre of this movement, the place that the mass conversion started. But now, with the announcement of Dr. Ambedkar's death, the hundreds of thousands of new Buddhists found themselves without a leader. It was Dr. Ambedkar who had given them the courage to take that step. It was his banner that they looked for above the chaos, that they looked to for courage. And now that banner was gone. They had stepped seriously out of line as far as Hindu India was concerned. They had created a lot of hostility against themselves. And now they were frightened and they were discouraged and they were leaderless. So this news came out on the day that Sangharakshita arrived in Nagpur. And when he arrived, Dr. Ambedkar's followers seemed paralysed by fear. They didn't know what to do. They seemed paralysed by fear. So Sangharakshita went into action. He immediately got them to organise a mass rally at which he would speak. And on the day he arrived, he got them to do that at 7 o'clock at night. So he didn't have a lot of time to prepare a great speech or anything. He was pretty much going into this impromptu. 100,000 people turned up. 100,000 people. This is like speaking to Wembley Stadium. I don't know if you've seen the King's Speech. You've seen the King's Speech? You know, he stands up in front of a whole stadium full of people. I mean, he's got the extra problem of having a stammer, but I think you might, you know, if you stood up in front of 100,000 people, you might find it a slightly daunting experience. I would. He stands up speaking to effectively more than Wembley Stadium. Imagine yourself. And he describes this as an extraordinary experience in which he wasn't focused on himself or his embarrassment or what impression he was making or whether he was doing a good speech. It says he says it was seemed to him he was responding to a force much bigger than himself, that it seemed to be acting through him. He had got out of the way and he was doing what needed to be done. And this had an electrifying effect. He communicated to Dr. Ambedkar's followers that the loss of Dr. Ambedkar was not the end. That they, his supporters, could carry on what he had started, what Dr. Ambedkar had started. So Sangharakshita got himself out of the way and responded with fearlessness, with lack of fear. And he bestowed that fearlessness on many, many others, met thousands and thousands of others. And over the next 4 days, he visited just about every Dalit neighbourhood in Nagpur. He addressed nearly 30 mass meetings in 4 days, giving talks non-stop, morning, noon and night. The last talk he gave started at 1:30 in the morning. In total, he reckons, about 200,000 people. This is outrageous behaviour. This is going beyond the bounds of what we normally consider reasonable for a human being to do. 4 days, 30 talks, 1:30 in the morning, 200,000 people. I think I'd be worried about doing that. I'd certainly be a little bit focused on me and my tiredness or something like that. But after this, Dr. Ambedkar's main supporters told Sangharakshita that he had saved Nagpur for Buddhism. He left people full of hope and courage and determined to work for the spread of Buddhism in India. Sangharakshita said of this time, this is what he actually wrote about this, "My own experience was most peculiar. I felt that I was not a person, but an impersonal force. At one stage, I was working quite literally without any thought, as though I was in samadhi. Also, I hardly felt any tiredness. Certainly not what one would have expected from such a great strain. And when I left Nagpur, I felt quite fresh and rested." So the fact that Sangharakshita got himself and his own concerns and any embarrassment he might have felt out of the way over those 4 days, and any concern for himself, had a massive impact. It had an absolutely massive impact. That act over those 4 days dramatically improved the lives of hundreds of thousands, in fact millions of people in decades to come. And it just shows just how effective, and just how fearless it's possible for us to be if we get ourselves out of the way and respond to a call that's bigger and more important than our own concerns. Thank you.